concentrating the most, perhaps, on what they had left out. They believed they remembered everything. He thought that Bill and Beverly almost did. But there was more. It would come to them, if it allowed them the time. In 1958, there had been no chance for preparation. They had talked endlessly, their talk interrupted only by the rock fight and that one act of group heroism at 29 Niebolt Street, and might, in the end, have done no more than talk. Then August 14th had come, and Henry and his friends had simply chased them into the sewers. Maybe I should have told them, he thought, putting the last of the magazines back in their places. But something spoke strongly against the idea. The voice of the turtle, he supposed. Perhaps that was part of it, and perhaps that sense of circularity was part of it, too. Maybe that last act was going to repeat itself in some updated fashion as well. He had put flashlights and miners' helmets carefully by against tomorrow. He had the blueprints of the dairy sewer and drain systems neatly rolled up and held with rubber bands in that same closet. But when they were kids, all their talk and all their plans, half-baked or otherwise, had come to nothing in the end. In the end, they had simply been chased into the drains, hurled into the confrontation which had followed. Was that going to happen again? Faith and power, he had come to believe, were interchangeable. Was the final truth even simpler? That no act of faith was possible until you were rudely pushed out into the screaming middle of things, like a newborn child skydiving shootlessly out of his mother's womb? Once you were falling, you were forced to believe in the chute, into existence, weren't you? Pulling the ring as you fell became your final statement on the subject, one way or the other. Jesus Christ, it's Fulton Sheen in blackface, Mike thought, and laughed a little. Mike cleaned, neatened, and thought his thoughts, while another part of his brain expected that he would finish and find himself tired enough to go home and sleep for a few hours. But when he finally did finish, he found himself as wide awake as ever. So he went to the single clothes stack behind his office, unlocking the wire gate with the key from his ring and letting himself in. This stack, supposedly fireproof when the vault-type door was closed and locked, contained the library's valuable first editions, books signed by writers long since dead. Among the signed editions were Moby Dick and Whitman's Leaves of Grass, historical matter relating to the town and the personal papers of a few of the few writers who had lived and worked in Derry. Mike hoped, if all of this ended well, to persuade Bill to leave his manuscripts to the Derry Public Library. Walking down the third aisle of the stack beneath tin-shaded light bulbs, smelling the familiar library scents of must and dust and cinnamony aging paper, he thought, when I die, I guess I'll go with a library card in one hand and an overdue stamp in the other. Well, maybe there's worse ways. He stopped halfway down this third aisle. His dog-eared steno notebook, which contained the jotted tales of Derry and his own troubled wanderings, was tucked between Frick's Old Derry Town and Michaud's History of Derry. He had pushed the notebook so far back it was nearly invisible. No one would stumble across it unless he was looking for it. Mike took it and went back to the table where they had held their meeting, pausing to turn off the lights in the closed stack and to relock the wire mesh. He sat down and flipped through the pages he had written, thinking what a strange, crippled affidavit it was. Part history, part scandal, part diary, part confessional. He had not logged an entry since April 6th. Have to get a new book soon, he thought, thumbing the few blank pages that were left. He thought bemusedly for a moment of Margaret Mitchell's first draft of Gone with the Wind, written in longhand in stacks and stacks and stacks of school composition books. Then he uncapped his pen and wrote, May 31st, two lines below the end of his last entry. He paused, looking vaguely across the empty library, and then began to write about everything that had happened during the last 3 days, beginning with his telephone call to Stanley Uris. He wrote quietly for 15 minutes, and then his concentration began to come unraveled. He paused more and more frequently. The image of Stan Uris's severed head in the refrigerator tried to intrude. Stan's bloody head, the mouth open and full of feathers, falling out of the refrigerator and rolling across the floor toward him. He banished it with an effort and went on writing. 5 minutes later, he jerked upright and looked around, convinced he would see that head rolling across the old black and red tiles of the main floor, eyes as glassy and avid as those in the mounted head of a deer. There was nothing. No head, no sound except the muffled drum of his own heart. got to get a hold of yourself, Mikey. It's the Jim Jams, that's all. Nothing else to it. But it was no use. The words began to get away from him. The thoughts seemed to dangle just out of reach. There was a pressure on the back of his neck, and it seemed to grow heavier. Being watched. He put his pen down and got up from the table. Is anyone here? He called, and his voice echoed back from the rotunda, giving him a jolt. He licked his lips and tried again. Bill? Ben? Bill, Hill, Ben, and? Suddenly, Mike decided he wanted to be home. He would simply take the notebook with him. He reached for it and heard a faint, sliding footstep. He looked up again. Pools of light surrounded by deepening lagoons of shadow. Nothing else. At least nothing he could see. He waited, heart beating hard. The footstep came again, and this time he pinpointed the location. The glassed-in passageway that connected the adult library to the children's library. In there, someone. Something. Moving quietly, Mike walked across to the checkout desk. The double doors leading into the passageway were held open by wooden chocks, and he could see a little way in. He could see what looked like feet, and with sudden swooning horror, he wondered if maybe Stan had come after all, if maybe Stan was going to step out of the shadows with his bird encyclopedia in one hand, his face white, his lips purple, his wrists and forearms cut open. I finally came, Stan would say. It took me a while because I had to pull myself out of a hole in the ground, but I finally came. There was another footstep, and now Mike could see shoes for sure. Shoes and ragged denim pant legs. Faded blue strings hung down against sockless ankles. And in the darkness, almost 6 feet above those ankles, he could see glittering eyes. He groped over the surface of the semicircular checkout desk and felt along the other side without taking his gaze from those eyes. His fingers felt one wooden corner of a small box. The overdue cards. A smaller box, paper clips and rubber bands. They happened on something that was metal and seized it. It was a letter opener with the words, Jesus Saves, stamped on the handle. A flimsy thing that had come in the mail from the Grace Baptist Church as part of a fundraising drive. Mike had not attended services in 15 years, but Grace Baptist had been his mother's church and he had sent them $5 he could not really afford. He had meant to throw the letter opener out, but it had stayed here amid the clutter on his side of the desk. Carol's side was always spotlessly clean. Until now. He clutched it tightly and stared into the shadowy hallway. There was another step. Another. Now the ragged denim pants were visible up to the knees. He could see the shape these lower legs belonged to. It was big, hulking. The shoulders were rounded. There was a suggestion of ragged hair. The figure was ape-like. Who are you? The shape merely stood there, contemplating him. Although still afraid, Mike had gotten over the debilitating idea that it might be Stan Uris, returned from the grave, called back by the scars on his palms, some eldritch magnetism which had brought him back like a zombie in a Hammer horror film. Whoever this was, it wasn't Stan Uris, who had finished at 5'7" when he had his full growth. The shape took another step, and now the light from the globe closest to the passageway fell across the beltless loops of the jeans around the shape's waist. Suddenly, Mike knew. Even before the shape spoke, he knew. Hello, nigger, the shape said. Been throwing rocks at anyone? Want to know who poisoned your fucking dog? The shape took another step forward, and the light fell on the face of Henry Bowers. It had grown fat and sagging. The skin had an unhealthy, tallowy hue. The cheeks had become hanging jowls that were specked with stubble, almost as much white in that stubble as black. Wavy lines, three of them, were engraved in the shelf of the forehead above the bushy brows. Other lines formed parentheses at the corners of the full-lipped mouth. The eyes were small and mean inside discolored pouches of flesh, bloodshot and thoughtless. It was the face of a man being pushed into a premature age, a man who was 39 going on 73. But it was also the face of a 12-year-old boy. Henry's clothes were still green with whatever bushes he had spent the day hiding in. Ain't you gonna say howdy, nigger? Henry asked. Hello, Henry. It occurred to him dimly that he had not listened to the radio for the last 2 days, and he had not even read the paper, which was a ritual with him. Too much going on, too busy, too bad. Henry emerged from the corridor between the children's library and the adult library and stood there, peering at Mike with his piggy eyes. His lips parted in an unspeakable grin, revealing rotted back main teeth.
"Voices," he said. "You ever hear voices, nigger?"
"Which voices are those, Henry?" He put both hands behind his back, like a schoolboy called upon to recite, and transferred the letter opener from his left hand to his right. The grandfather clock, given by Horst Mueller in 1923, ticked solemn seconds into the smooth pond of library silence.
"From the moon," Henry said.
He put a hand in his pocket.
"Came from the moon. Lots of voices."
He paused, frowned slightly, then shook his head.
"Lots, but really only one. Its voice."
"Did you see it, Henry?"
"Yep," Henry said. "Frankenstein tore off Victor's head. You should have heard it. Made a sound like a great big zipper going down. Then it went after Belch. Belch fought it."
"Did he?"
"Yep. That's how I got away."
"You left him to die."
"Don't you say that."
Henry's cheeks flushed a dull red. He took two steps forward. The farther he walked from the umbilicus connecting the children's library to the adult library, the younger he looked to Mike. He saw the same old meanness in Henry's face, but he saw something else as well. The child who had been brought up by crazy Butch Bowers on a good farm that had gone to shit-shack shambles over the years.
"Don't you say that. It would have killed me, too."
"It didn't kill us." Henry's eyes gleamed with rancid humor.
"Not yet, but it will. Less I don't leave any of you for it to get."
He pulled his hand out of his pocket. In it was a slim 9-inch-long instrument with imitation ivory inlays along its sides. A small chromium button glittered at one end of this dubious objet d'art. Henry pushed it. A 6-inch steel blade popped out of the slit at the end of the handle. He bounced the switchblade on his palm and began to walk toward the checkout desk a little faster.
"Look what I found," he said. "I knew where to look."
Obscenely, one red-rimmed eyelid drooped in a wink.
"The man in the moon told me."
Henry revealed his teeth again.
"Hid today. Hitchhiked a ride tonight. Old man. Hit him. Killed him, I think. Ditched the car over in Newport, just over the dairy town line. I heard that voice. I looked in a drain. There was these clothes and the knife. My old knife."
"You're forgetting something, Henry." Henry, grinning, only shook his head.
"We got away and you got away. If it wants us, it wants you too."
"No."
"I think yes.
Maybe you yo-yos did its work, but it didn't exactly play favorites, did it?
It got both of your friends, and while Belch was fighting it, you got away. But now you're back. I think you're part of its unfinished business, Henry. I really do."
"No."
"Maybe Frankenstein's what you'll see, or the werewolf. A vampire? The clown?
Or, Henry, maybe you'll really see what it looks like,
Henry."
"We did. Want me to tell you? Want me to..."
"You shut up!"
Henry screamed and launched himself at Mike. Mike stepped aside and stuck out one foot. Henry tripped over it and went skidding over the foot-worn tiles like a shuffleboard weight. His head struck a leg of the table where the losers had sat earlier that night telling their tales. For a moment he was stunned. The knife hung loose in his hand. Mike went after him, went after the knife. In that moment, he could have finished Henry. It would have been possible to plant the Jesus Saves letter opener, which had come in the mail from his mother's old church, in the back of Henry's neck and then call the police. There would have been a certain amount of official nonsense, but not too much of it, not in Derry, where such weird and violent events were not entirely exceptional. What stopped him was a realization almost too lightning-like to be conscious, that if he killed Henry, he would be doing its work as surely as Henry would be doing its work by killing Mike. And something else. That other look he had seen on Henry's face, the tired, bewildered look of the badly used child who has been sent on a poisonous path for some unknown purpose. Henry had grown up within the contaminated radius of Butch Bowers' mind. Surely he had belonged to it even before he suspected it existed. So instead of planting the letter opener in Henry's vulnerable neck, he dropped to his knees and snatched at the knife. It twisted in his hand, seemingly of its own volition, and his fingers closed on the blade. There was no immediate pain, only red blood flowing down the first three fingers of his right hand and into his scarred palm. He pulled back. Henry rolled away and grabbed the knife again. Mike got to his knees and the two of them faced each other that way, each bleeding. Mike's fingers, Henry's nose. Henry shook his head and droplets flew away into the darkness.
"Thought you were so smart," he cried hoarsely. "Fucking sissies is all you were. We could have beat you in a fair fight."
"Put the knife down, Henry," Mike said quietly. "I'll call the police. They'll come and get you and take you back to Juniper Hill. You'll be out of Derry. You'll be safe."
Henry tried to talk and couldn't. He couldn't tell this hateful jig that he wouldn't be safe in Juniper Hill or Los Angeles or the rainforests of Timbuktu. Sooner or later, the moon would rise, bone white and snow cold, and the ghost voices would start. And the face of the moon would change into its face, babbling and laughing and ordering. He swallowed slick, slimy blood.
"You never fought fair,
did you?" Mike asked.
"You nigger boogie night fighter jungle bunny ape man coon," Henry screamed and leaped at Mike again.
Mike leaned back to avoid his blundering, awkward rush, overbalanced, and went sprawling on his back. Henry struck the table again, rebounded, turned, and clutched Mike's arm. Mike swept the letter opener around and felt it go deep into Henry's forearm. Henry screamed, but instead of letting go, he tightened his grip. He pulled himself toward Mike, his hair in his eyes, blood flowing from his ruptured nose over his thick lips. Mike tried to get a foot in Henry's side and push him away. Henry swung the switchblade in a glittering arc. All 6 inches of it went into Mike's thigh. It went in effortlessly, as if into a warm cake of butter. Henry pulled it out, dripping, and with a scream of combined pain and effort, Mike shoved him away. He struggled to his feet, but Henry was up more quickly, and Mike was barely able to avoid Henry's next blundering rush. He could feel blood pouring down his leg in an alarming flood, filling his loafer.
"He got my femoral artery, I think. Jesus, he got me bad. Blood everywhere. Blood on the floor. Shoes won't be any good. Shit, just bought them 2 months ago."
Henry came again, panting and puffing like a bull in heat. Mike staggered aside and swept the letter opener at him again. It tore through Henry's ragged shirt and pulled a deep cut across his ribs. Henry grunted as Mike shoved him away again.
"You dirty fighting nigger," he wailed. "Look what you done."
"Drop the knife, Henry," Mike said.
There was a titter from behind them. Henry looked, and then screamed in utter horror, clapping his hands to his cheeks like an offended old maid. Mike's gaze jerked toward the circulation desk. There was a loud, vibrating kaspang sound, and Stan Urus's head popped up from behind the desk. A spring corkscrewed up and into his severed, dripping neck. His face was livid with grease paint. There was a fever spot of rouge on each cheek. Great orange pom-poms flowered where the eyes had been. This grotesque Stan-in-the-box head nodded back and forth at the end of its spring like one of the giant sunflowers beside the house on Niebolt Street. Its mouth opened, and a squealing, laughing voice began to chant,
"Kill him, Henry! Kill the nigger! Kill the coon! Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!"
Mike wheeled back toward Henry, dismally aware that he had been tricked, wondering faintly whose head Henry had seen at the end of the spring. Stan's? Victor Chris's? His father's, perhaps. Henry shrieked and rushed at Mike, the switchblade plunging up and down like the needle of a sewing machine.
"Gah, nigger!" Henry was screaming, "Gah, nigger, gah, nigger."
Mike backpedaled, and the leg Henry had stabbed buckled under him almost at once, spilling him to the floor. There was hardly any feeling at all left in that leg. It felt cold and distant. Looking down, he saw that his cream-colored slacks were now bright red. Henry's blade flashed by in front of his nose. Mike stabbed out with the Jesus Saves letter opener as Henry turned back for another go. Henry ran into it like a bug onto a pin. Warm blood doused Mike's hand. There was a snap, and when he drew his hand back, he only had the haft of the letter opener. The rest was sticking out of Henry's stomach.
"Gah, nigger!"
Henry screamed, clapping a hand over the protruding jag of blade. Blood poured through his fingers. He looked at it with bulging, unbelieving eyes. The head at the end of the creaking, dipping jack-in-the-box squealed and laughed. Mike, feeling sick and dizzy now, looked back at it and saw Belch Huggins' head, a human champagne cork wearing a New York Yankees baseball cap, turned backward. He groaned aloud, and the sound was far away, echoey in his own ears. He was aware that he was sitting in a pool of warm blood.
"If I don't get a tourniquet on my leg, I'm going to die."
Gah! Miga!
Henry screamed. Still holding his bleeding belly with one hand and the switchblade with the other, he staggered away from Mike and toward the library doors. He wove drunkenly from side to side, progressing across the echoing main room like a pinball in an electronic game. He struck one of the easy chairs and knocked it over. His groping hand spilled a rack of newspapers onto the floor. He reached the doors, straight-armed one of them, and plunged out into the night. Mike's consciousness was fading now. He worked at the buckle of his belt with his fingers he could barely feel. At last he got it unhooked and managed to pull it free of its loops. He put it around his bleeding leg just below the groin and cinched it tight. Holding with one hand, he began to crawl toward the circulation desk. The phone was there. He wasn't sure how he was going to reach it, but for now that didn't matter. The trick was just to get there. The world wavered, blurred, grew faint behind waves of gray. He stuck his tongue out and bit down on it savagely. The pain was immediate and exquisite. The world swam back into focus. He became aware that he was still holding the ragged haft of the letter opener, and he tossed it away. Here at last was the circulation desk, looking as tall as Everest. Mike got his good leg under him and pushed himself up, clutching at the edge of the desk with the hand that wasn't holding the belt tight. His mouth was drawn down into a trembling grimace, his eyes slitted. At last he managed to get all the way up. He stood there, stork-like, and hooked the phone over to him. Taped to the side were three numbers, fire, police, and hospital. With one shaking finger that looked at least 10 miles away, Mike dialed the hospital, 555-3711. He closed his eyes as the phone began to ring, and then they opened wide as the voice of Pennywise the Clown answered.
Howdy, nigger,
Pennywise cried, and then screamed laughter as sharp as broken glass into Mike's ear.
What do you say? How you doing? I think you're dead. What do you think? I think Henry did the job on you. Want a balloon, Mikey? Want a balloon? How you doing? Hello there.
Mike's eyes turned up to the face of the grandfather clock, the Mueller clock, and saw with no surprise at all that its face had been replaced by his father's face, gray and rattled with cancer. The eyes were turned up to show only bulging whites. Suddenly his father popped his tongue out and the clock began to strike. Mike lost his grip on the circulation desk. He swayed for a moment on his good leg and then he fell down again. The phone swung before him at the end of its cord like a mesmerist's amulet. It was becoming very hard to hold onto the belt now.
Hello there, Amos,
Pennywise cried brightly from the swinging telephone handset.
This here's de Kingfish. I is de Kingfish in Derry anyhow, and that's de truth. Wouldn't you say so, boy?
If there's anyone there, Mike croaked, a real voice behind the one I am hearing, please help me. My name is Michael Hanlon, and I'm at the Derry Public Library. I am bleeding to death. If you're there, I can't hear you. I'm not being allowed to hear you. If you're there, please hurry.
He lay on his side, drawing his legs up until he was in a fetal position. He took two turns around his right hand with the belt and concentrated on holding it as the world drifted away in those cottony, balloon-like clouds of gray.
Hello there, how you doing?
Pennywise screamed from the dangling, swinging phone.
How you doing, you dirty coon? Hello?
4. Kansas Street, 12:20 p.m. There, Henry Bowers said.
How you doing, you little cunt?
Beverly reacted instantly, turning to run. It was a quicker reaction than any of them had expected. She might actually have gotten a running start, but for her hair. Henry snatched, caught part of its long flow, and pulled her back. He grinned into her face. His breath was thick and warm and stinking.
How you doing?
Henry Bowers asked her.
Where you going? Back to play with your asshole friends some more? I think I'll cut off your nose and make you eat it. You like that?
She struggled to get free. Henry laughed and shook her head back and forth by the hair. The knife flashed dangerously in the hazy August sunshine. Abruptly, a car horn honked, a long blast.
Here, here, what are you boys doing? Let that girl go.
It was an old lady behind the wheel of a well-preserved 1950 Ford. She had pulled up to the curb and was leaning across the blanket-covered seat to peer out the passenger side window. At the sight of her angry, honest face, the dazed look left Victor Chris's eyes for the first time, and he looked nervously at Henry.
What? Please,
Bev cried shrilly.
He's got a knife, a knife.
The old lady's anger now became concern, surprise, and fear as well.
What are you boys doing? Let her alone.
Across the street, Bev saw this quite clearly, Herbert Ross got out of the lawn chair on his porch, approached the porch rail, and looked over. His face was as blank as Belch Huggins's. He folded his paper, turned, and went quietly into the house.
Let her be,
the old lady cried shrilly. Henry bared his teeth and suddenly ran at her car, dragging Beverly after him by the hair. She stumbled, went to one knee, was dragged. The pain in her scalp was excruciating, monstrous. She felt some of her hair rip out. The old lady screamed and cranked the passenger side window frantically. Henry stabbed down and the switchblade skated across the glass. The woman's foot came off the old Ford's clutch pedal and it went down Kansas Street in three big jerks, bouncing up over the curb where it stalled. Henry went after it, still pulling Beverly along. Victor licked his lips and looked around. Belch pushed the New York Yankees baseball cap he was wearing up on his forehead and then dug at his ear in a puzzled gesture. Bev saw the old woman's white, frightened face for one moment and then saw her pawing at the door locks, first on the passenger side, then on her own. The Ford's engine ground and caught. Henry lifted one booted foot and kicked out a taillight.
Get out of here, you dried-up old bitch!
The tires screamed as the old lady pulled back out in the street. An oncoming pickup truck swerved to avoid her, its horn blatted. Henry turned back toward Bev, beginning to smile again, and she hiked one sneakered foot directly into his balls. The smile on Henry's face turned into a grimace of agony. The switch knife dropped from his hand and clattered onto the sidewalk. His other hand left its nesting place in the tangle of her hair, pulling once more terribly as it went. And then he sank to his knees, trying to scream, holding his crotch. She could see strands of her own coppery hair in one of his hands, and in that instant all of her terror turned to bright hate. She drew in a great hitching breath and hocked a remarkably large Louis onto the top of his head. Then she turned and ran. Belch lumbered three steps after her and stopped. He and Victor went to Henry, who threw them aside and staggered to his feet, both hands still cupping his balls. It was not the first time that summer that he had been kicked there. He leaned over and picked up the switchblade.
On,
he wheezed.
What, Henry?
Belch said anxiously. Henry turned a face toward him that was so full of sweating pain and sick, blazing hate that Belch fell back a step.
I said, come on,
he managed, and began to stagger and lurch up the street after Beverly, holding his crotch.
We can't catch her now, Henry,
Victor said uneasily. Hell, you can hardly walk.
We'll catch her,
Henry panted. His upper lip was rising and falling in an unconscious dog-like sneer. Beads of sweat stood on his forehead and ran down his hectic cheeks.
We'll catch her, all right, because I know where she's going. She's going down into the barrens to be with her asshole.
5. The Derry Townhouse, 2 a.m.
Friends, Beverly said.
Hmm? Bill looked at her. His thoughts had been far away. They had been walking hand in hand, the silence between them companionable and slightly charged with mutual attraction. He had caught only the last word of what she had said. A block ahead, the lights of the townhouse shone through the low ground fog.
I said you were my best friends, the only friends I ever had back then.
She smiled.
Making friends has never been my strong suit, I guess, although I've got a good one back in Chicago. A woman named Kay McCall. I think you'd like her, Bill.
Probably would. I've never been real fast to make friends myself. He smiled. Back then, we were all we needed. He saw beads of moisture in her hair, appreciated the way the lights made a nimbus around her head. Her eyes were turned gravely up to his.
I need something now, she said.
Well, what's that?
I need you to kiss me, she said.
He thought of Audra, and for the first time it occurred to him that she looked like Beverly. He wondered if maybe that had been the attraction all along, the reason he had been able to find guts enough to ask Audra out near the end of the Hollywood party where they had met. He felt a pang of unhappy guilt, and then he took Beverly, his childhood friend, in his arms. Her kiss was firm and warm and sweet. Her breasts pushed against his open coat and her hips moved against him, away, and then against him again. When her hips moved away a second time, he plunged both of his hands into her hair and moved against her. When she felt him growing hard, she uttered a little gasp and put her face against the side of his neck. He felt her tears on his skin, warm and secret.
Come on, she said, quick.
He
He took her hand and they walked the rest of the way to the townhouse. The lobby was old, festooned with plants, and still possessed of a certain fading charm. The decor was very much 19th century lumberman. It was deserted at this hour, except for the desk clerk, who could be dimly seen in the inner office, his feet cocked up on the desk watching TV. Bill pushed the third floor button with a finger that trembled just slightly. Excitement? Nervousness? Guilt? All of the above? Oh, yeah, sure, and a kind of almost insane joy and fear as well. These feelings did not mix pleasantly, but they seemed necessary. He led her down the hallway toward his room, deciding in some confused way that if he were to be unfaithful, it should be a complete act of infidelity consummated in his place and not hers. He found himself thinking of Susan Brown, his first book agent, and, when he was not quite 20, his first lover.
Cheating. Cheating on my wife.
He tried to get this through his head, but it seemed both real and unreal at the same time. What seemed strongest was an unhappy sense of homesickness, an old-fashioned feeling of falling away. Audra would be up by now, making coffee, sitting at the kitchen table in her robe, perhaps studying lines, perhaps reading a Dick Francis novel. His key rattled in the lock of room 311. If they had gone to Beverly's room on the fifth floor, they would have seen the message light on her phone blinking. The TV-watching desk clerk would have given her a message to call her friend Kay in Chicago. After Kay's third frantic call, he had finally remembered to post the message. Things might have taken a different course. The five of them might not have been fugitives from the Derry police when that day's light finally broke. But they went to his, as things had perhaps been arranged. The door opened. They were inside. She looked at him, eyes bright, cheeks flushed, her breast rising and falling rapidly. He took her in his arms and was overwhelmed by the feeling of rightness, the feeling of the circle between past and present closing with a triumphant seamlessness. He kicked the door shut clumsily with one foot, and she laughed her warm breath into his mouth.
"My heart,"
she said, and put his hand on her left breast. He could feel it below that firm, almost maddening softness, racing like an engine.
"Your heart. My heart."
They were on the bed, still dressed, kissing. Her hand slipped inside his shirt, then out again. She traced a finger down the row of buttons, paused at his waist. And then that same finger slipped lower, tracing down the stony thickness of his cock. Muscles he hadn't been aware of jumped and fluttered in his groin. He broke the kiss and moved his body away from hers on the bed.
"Bill, got to stop for a minute," he said,
"or else I'm going to shoot in my pants like a kid." She laughed again, softly, and looked at him.
"Is it that? Or are you having second thoughts?"
"Second thoughts," Bill said. I always have those."
"I don't. I hate him," she said.
He looked at her, the smile fading.
"I didn't know it all the way to the top of my mind until two nights ago," she said. "Oh, I knew it somewhere, all along, I guess. He hits and he hurts. I married him because my father always worried about me, I guess. No matter how hard I tried, he worried. And I guess I knew he'd approve of Tom, because Tom always worried, too. He worried a lot. And as long as someone was worrying about me, I'd be safe. More than safe, real."
She looked at him solemnly. Her blouse had pulled out of the waistband of her slacks, revealing a white stripe of stomach. He wanted to kiss it.
"But it wasn't real. It was a nightmare. Being married to Tom was like going back into the nightmare. Why would a person do that, Bill? Why would a person go back into the nightmare of her own accord?"
Bill said, The only reason I can figure is that people go back to find themselves."
"The nightmare's here," Bev said. "The nightmare is Derry. Tom looks small compared to that. I can see him better now. I loathe myself for the years I spent with him. You don't know. The things he made me do, and oh, I was happy enough to do them, you know, because he worried about me. I'd cry. But sometimes there's too much shame, you know?"
"Don't," he said quietly, and put his hand over hers. She held it tightly. Her eyes were overbright, but the tears didn't fall.
"Everybody goofs it, but it's not an exam. You just go through it the best you can."
"What I mean," she said, "is that I'm not cheating on Tom, or trying to use you to get my own back on him, or anything like that. For me, it would be like something
sane and normal and sweet. But I don't want to hurt you, Bill, or trick you into something you'll be sorry for later. He thought about this, thought about it with a real and deep seriousness. But the odd little mnemonic, "he thrusts his fists," and so on, began to circle back, breaking into his thoughts. It had been a long day. Mike's call and the invitation to lunch at Jade of the Orient seemed 100 years ago. So many stories since then, so many memories, like photographs from George's album. "Friends don't trick each other," he said, and leaned toward her on the bed. Their lips touched and he began to unbutton her blouse. One of her hands went to the back of his neck and held him closer, while the other first unzipped her slacks and then pushed them down. For a moment his hand was on her stomach, warm. Then her panties were gone in a whisper. Then he nudged and she guided. As he entered her, she arched her back gently toward the thrust of his sex and muttered, "Be my friend. I love you, Bill." "I love you too," he said, smiling against her bare shoulder. They began slowly, and he felt sweat begin to flow out of his skin as she quickened beneath him. His consciousness began to drain downward, becoming focused more and more strongly on their connection. Her pores had opened, releasing a lovely musky odor. Beverly felt her climax coming. She moved toward it, working for it, never doubting it would come. Her body suddenly stuttered and seemed to leap upward, not orgasming, but reaching a plateau far above any she had reached with Tom or the two lovers she had before Tom. She became aware that this wasn't going to be just a cum. It was going to be a tactical nuke. She became a little afraid, but her body picked up the rhythm again. She felt Bill's long length stiffen against her, his whole body suddenly becoming as hard as the part of him inside herself. And at that same moment she climaxed, began to climax. Pleasure so great it was nearly agony spilled out of unsuspected floodgates, and she bit down on his shoulder to stifle her cries. "Oh my God," Bill gasped, and although she was never sure later, she believed he was crying. He pulled back, and she thought he was going to withdraw from her. She tried to prepare for that moment, which always brought a fleeting, inexplicable sense of loss and emptiness, something like a footprint. And then he thrust forward strongly again. Right away, she had a second orgasm, something she hadn't known was possible for her, and the window of memory opened again and she saw birds, thousands of birds, descending onto every roof peak and telephone line and RFD mailbox in Derry. Spring birds against a white April sky, and there was pain mixed with pleasure. But mostly it was low, as a white spring sky seems low. Low physical pain mixed with low physical pleasure, and some crazy sense of affirmation. She had bled. She had... "All of you?" she cried suddenly, her eyes widening, stunned. He did pull back and out of her this time, but in the sudden shock of the revelation, she barely felt him go. "What, Beverly? Are you all right? All of you? I made love to all of you?" She saw a shocked surprise on Bill's face, the drop of his jaw, and sudden understanding. But it was not her revelation. Even in her own shock, she saw that. It was his own. Bill, what is it? "That was your way to get us out," he said. And now his eyes blazed so brightly they frightened her. "Beverly, don't you understand? That was your way to get us out. We all... But we were..." Suddenly he looked frightened, unsure. "Do you remember the rest now?" she asked. He shook his head slowly. "Not the specifics, but..." He looked at her, and she saw he was badly frightened. "What it really came down to was, we wished our way out. And I'm not sure, Beverly, I'm not sure that grown-ups can do that." She looked at him without speaking for a long moment, then sat on the edge of the bed with no particular self-consciousness. Her body was smooth and lovely, the line of her backbone barely discernible in the dimness as she bent to take off the knee-high nylon stocking she had been wearing. Her hair was a sheaf coiled over one shoulder. He thought he would want her again before morning, and that feeling of guilt came again, tempered only by the shameful comfort of knowing that Audra was an ocean away. "Put another nickel in the jukebox," he thought. "This tune is called What She Don't Know Won't Hurt Her, but it hurts somewhere, in the spaces between people, maybe." Beverly got up and turned the bed down. "Come to bed. We need sleep, both of us." All right. Because that was right. That was a big 10-4. More than anything else, he wanted to sleep. But not alone, not tonight. The latest shock was wearing off. Too quickly, perhaps. But he felt so tired now, so used up. Second-to-second reality had the quality of a dream, and in spite of his guilt, he felt that this was a safe place. It would be possible to lie here for a little while, to sleep in her arms. He wanted her warmth and her friendliness. Both were sexually charged, but that could hurt neither of them now. He stripped off his socks and shirt and got in next to her. She pressed against him, her breasts warm, her long legs cool. Bill held her, aware of the differences. Her body was longer than Audra's and fuller at the breast and the hip, but it was a welcome body.
It should have been Ben with you, dear,
he thought drowsily.
I think that was the way it was really supposed to be. Why wasn't it Ben? Because it was you then and it's you now, that's all. Because what goes around always comes around. I think Bob Dylan said that. Or maybe it was Ronald Reagan. And maybe it's me now because Ben's the one who's supposed to see the lady home.
Beverly wriggled against him, not in a sexual way, although even as he fled toward sleep, she felt him stir again against her leg and was glad, but only wanting his warmth. She was already half asleep herself. Her happiness here with him after all these years was real. She knew that because of its bitter undertaste. There was tonight, and perhaps there would be another time for them tomorrow morning. Then they would go down in the sewers as they had before, and they would find their it. The circle would close ever tighter. Their present lives would merge smoothly with their own childhoods. They would become like creatures on some crazy Mobius strip. Either that, or they would die down there. She turned over. He slipped an arm between her side and her arm and cupped one breast gently. She did not have to lie awake, wondering if the hand might suddenly clamp down in a hard pinch. Her thoughts began to break up as sleep slid into her. As always, she saw brilliant wildflower patterns as she crossed over, masses and masses of them nodding brightly under a blue sky. These faded and there was a falling sensation, the sort of sensation that had sometimes snapped her awake and sweating as a child, a scream on the other side of her face. Childhood dreams of falling, she had read in her college psychology text, were common. But she didn't snap back this time. She could feel the warm and comforting weight of Bill's arm, his hand cradling her breast. She thought that if she was falling, at least she wasn't falling alone.
End of side 24. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.